Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. We're continuing today with the theme of the decline of French imperialism in Indochina as we get closer to the catastrophe of Dien Bien Phu. Now, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, you'll know that I've mentioned Dien Bien Phu a couple of times, and it's a topic that I like to return to, as with the fall of Singapore in early 1942. Dien Bien Phu is one of those critical moments in 20th century history where the tide of Western imperialism in Asia is essentially reversed. And the verdict of Dien Bien Phu was the end not just of French imperialism in Indochina, but it sent shockwaves throughout the remainder of the French Empire in the Middle East, North Africa, and in sub-Saharan Africa. So we'll look today at the growing political crisis and political weariness over the war in Indochina and the effect that Dien Bien Phu has on that. So again, we're reading from Fight or Flight by Martin Thomas. And previously, when we had looked at this chapter, the very idea of the French Union, which was to be the kind of post-imperial or post-directly colonial dominion system that would exist within Indochina of states within the broader French Empire, but with a degree of autonomy and a degree of kind of local economic and political codependency. This scheme falls apart in 1953 when Cambodia is given full independence as a result of huge protests from Cambodia as a result of a kind of a reckless French intervention in the economies of the various Indochinese states. You can hear more about that on the previous podcast. Martin Thomas writes, "Back in Paris, war weariness was exacting a heavier toll. All of the governing parties identified with starting, expanding or sustaining the war, the MRP, the Socialists, the Radicals and the UDSR, were now internally divided over it. Public opposition to the conflict was also harder to ignore. Journalists took the lead. Some wrote for a reinvigorated Catholic press, tending to focus on the conflict's ethical dimensions. Others criticised the war's shadowy politics in the Fourth Republic's flagship newspaper, Le Monde, founded in 1946. And longer, in-depth critiques appeared in another newly established title, The Weekly L'Express. Throughout the national press, a steady stream of press editorials decried past administrative failures and question the wisdom of continued military engagement. So there's some fascinating parallels once again here with America and the 1970s, particularly the publishing of the Pentagon Papers and later the Watergate scandal. Here we have formerly united parties in France, just as you later get in America, who believe in the idea of the war, riven with internal divisions in the final days of the war and recriminations and the debate as to stick or twist, to carry on hoping that somehow something will turn up or to cut one's losses with the political fallout that comes with that. And the newspapers become the bane of the government's life. And that is only really because the newspapers echo what broader public opinion says anyway. And of course, none of this political turmoil escaped the notice of Washington. Again, Martin Thomas writes, "Watching France's fight strategy unravel in late 1953, Eisenhower's Republican administration worked behind the scenes to ensure that a new coalition government under Joseph Laniel conceded independence to the governments in Phnom Penh, Luang Prabang and Saigon. The Associated States idea, a cornerstone of the original French Union scheme, was dead." In the previous podcast, we talked about the achievements of Delattre, the leader of the French military expedition in Vietnam, who died in 1953. And one of the interesting and perhaps fateful byproducts of Delattre's success — Delattre was obviously a very talented commander, but he was equipped with American hardware — was the Chinese military aid group, the Chinese advisors who passed from China into northern Vietnam to advise the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, the communist government in the north. The CMAG took the lesson from Delattre's successors that even more military hardware needed to be piled up, and that the North Vietnamese, the DRV, needed to redouble its efforts to expand its manpower, to conduct further guerrilla raids, to prepare for an even more intense battle to come. The result of Delattre was to redouble the commitment of the Vietnamese communists to outright military victory, and this meant that they favoured that as a strategy over negotiation, believing that once the French had been finally humiliated in Vietnam, then it would be possible to secure any kind of withdrawal from them that was possible, that they chose. The Vietnamese Workers' Party, which was the political vehicle of Ho Chi Minh, was relaunched in 1951. Vo Nguyen Giap, Ho Chi Minh, and the party secretary, Truong Kinh, were certain that the only way to have a removal of colonialism from Vietnam was to have a political revolution at the same time, so that the French could be physically removed from Vietnam, and thereafter an entirely new social system would have to be put into place, and the possibility of Vietnamese people replicating the colonial structures left behind and replicating the oppression of colonialism was entirely possible. However, the answer that Ho Chi Minh sought was to look to the example of Mao's government in China. And as we've seen before, particularly in the works of Frank Dakota, the period 1949 to 57 in China was known, the period of liberation, was hardly a liberating experience for most ordinary Chinese. The argument that Mao and Ho Chi Minh came up with, which is drawn from a kind of Marxist-Leninism, is that in order to have a social transformation to socialism, one needs to establish a, in Marx's eyes, a very short-lived dictatorship. But the communist leaders of the 20th century very often ignored the brevity, the intended brevity of this, and instead saw it as a kind of an ongoing kind of class dictatorship with all the violence and bloodshed and oppression that resulted in. And Martin Thomas writes, to consolidate the power, the VWP, the Vietnamese Workers' Party, Politburo, concerted plans with Mao's government to consolidate their grip over Vietnam's northwestern provinces and neighbouring territory in Laos. After Giap's regular units opened the Zam Noir offensive in Upper Laos in late March 1953, DRV forces began infiltrating southwards from their Viet Bac stronghold. This time around, it was harder to envisage them being dislodged. The revolution proceeded meanwhile. The pace of communal land redistribution within liberated zones quickened. Party propagandists warned that peasant families who remained loyal to Bao Dai, the Vietnamese emperor, would be denied a share of the spoils. This was a direct riposte to the emperor's last-ditch efforts to sway the rural population with the promise of land reforms, a programme derailed by furious opposition from the Vietnamese landlords along the fertile banks of the Red River and the Mekong Delta. The French were interested in being able to have a back channel to Ho Chi Minh, and the French Commander General for Southeast Asia, the former Free French diplomat Maurice Dijon, served as the intermediary between the France and its client regimes, but also the facilitator of a diplomatic back channel to Hanoi itself. Dijon held up the fiction that the Cambodian and Laotian governments were willing and equal partners in the fight against the Hanoi regime. By the late stage of the war, the Laotians were arguably the keener of the two. From August 1953 onwards, intensive French-Laotian frontier patrolling disrupted the DRV supply lines in what we would later kind of know as the Ho Chi Minh Trail. These minor successes in the north were overshadowed by a worsening crisis of authority in Saigon. The Emperor Bao Dai was caught in a difficult position. He was very much compromised by his long-standing association with the French to make himself a credible national leader. The southward flood of refugees pointed to a popular longing for a decent non-communist alternative in Vietnam, and Bao Dai did not fit the bill. So the more romantic idea that the communists were the nationally unanimously popular party of liberation perhaps needs a bit of revising here. There was certainly widespread appeal for the basic message of land redistribution amongst the peasants, but there were significant numbers of people that had experienced the harsh justice of the communists. And perhaps smaller businessmen and more well-to-do farmers that had been expropriated and had lost their wealth. So there was a significant number of people looking for an alternative to the communists. It's just that the French and the Americans, between them, never managed to produce a credible one.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The decline of French influence as more and more Vietnamese began to strongly suspect that the French would leave and that the French couldn't win a decisive battle against the DRV meant that there was less and less chance that they would be able to influence Vietnamese politics and that they would be able to ensure a French-backed puppet ruler would remain in power. As a result, the factionalism of South Vietnamese politics increased with a rash of small parties and their own paramilitary forces emerging. The declining French capacity, Martin Thomas writes, to control events in Saigon was matched by an inability to regulate international involvement in the war. Communist China's immersion in the conflict was, of course, an accomplished fact. But the cessation of the Korean War in July 1953 released Chinese strategic energies to focus on securing victory in Indochina. With the Korean armistice finally concluded, and as autumn 1953 turned to winter, it became clearer that the Cold War giants were positioning themselves for Indochina's future without France. On the 19th of September 1953, Georgi Malenkov, appointed Soviet premier following Stalin's death 6 months earlier, proposed a negotiated settlement, reasoning that the USSR's Chinese ally should figure large in any peace talks. 6 weeks later, US Vice President Richard Nixon met the heads of the government in Saigon, Phnom Penh and Luang Prabang. The Indo-Chinese Peninsula, he insisted, had overtaken Korea as America's foremost strategic priority in Eastern Asia. The vice president pledged that Eisenhower's administration would redouble its efforts to defeat Hanoi, the implication being that France might have to do America's bidding if it failed to make military progress soon. The fight in Indochina was slipping out of French hands and into the grasp of stronger outsiders. Now this, for me, is that crucial pivot moment where it starts to cease being a French conflict and starts to become a Cold War struggle. There is a kind of a merging, an overlapping of anti-colonial struggle and a wider kind of Cold War dimension. And this appears to be that moment when all of a sudden the likes of Malenkov start to become involved, and that the US start to, and Eisenhower and Nixon start to make pronouncements on the importance of Vietnam, and they see the importance because they imagine what life will be like if the French lose, and then really they start to ask themselves when the French lose. So the conflict becomes no longer really France's to decide. And that sense becomes overwhelming in 1954. The loss of control converges, as we know, on the decisive event of Dien Bien Phu. The siege that befalls the French garrison at the Northern Fortress Complex of Dien Bien Phu. And the other key event was the convocation of an international conference at Geneva to negotiate an armistice and to end the fighting. At the peace talks, the French attempted to portray the war in Vietnam as a product of Chinese meddling. They were able to show, and this is true, that in 1945 to 46, Chinese nationalists who had marched into Vietnam from the north at the end of the Second World War had managed to hamper the French from recolonising the north and keeping French officials from travelling north. And they were also able to intercept Chinese intelligence, which showed the scope of Maoist assistance to the Hanoi regime. The whole effort was to delegitimize the war as a kind of popular mobilization against colonialism, and to present the war as the kind of the creeping movement forward of international communism. This was obviously meant to appeal to an American narrative. Martin Thomas writes, "Diplomatic skirmishing was one thing, but the French nation, only fitfully engaged by the preceding 8 years of the Indochina War, was in early 1954 gripped by the unfolding tragedy of Dien Bien Phu. Night after night, from January through to May, Pathé, Gaumont and Gaumont newsreels relayed the garrison's depletion to cinema audiences. Between the 20th of March and the 15th of May, Paris Match published 144 battlefield photographs, including five front covers, variously depicting stretcher-bound casualties and stoical defenders, hopelessly outnumbered, staring out from the newsstands. These graphic, sorrowful images registered a huge impact, making the national heroine of one aristocratic French Air Force nurse, Lieutenant Genevieve de Gallard, nicknamed the Angel of Dien Bien Phu." So, the catastrophic decision of the French to establish a forward base in North Vietnam in a valley, principally because there were airfields there that could be resupplied, and one last-ditch attempt to win a strategic battle in North Vietnam, perhaps to bring about better odds, better outcomes during negotiations, was totally undermined by the fact that the North Vietnamese were still assisted by China, were still equipped with Chinese artillery and rockets, and were able to pour fire from the mountaintops down into the valley. The French, who were undermanned, they relied on significant numbers of colonial troops, African troops, and other Vietnamese troops, and who were at a point whereby many people in the French government believed the cause was lost anyway, held out bravely for several months until the end was inevitable. And Martin Thomas writes, "The DRV's gargantuan logistical task in relaying troops, munitions and food to the hills surrounding Dien Bien Phu was only tangentially apparent in the images of artillery bombardments and wave after wave of infantry assaults, but photographs and film footage of bodies strewn across the Dien Bien Phu's valley floor were real enough. Stark warnings from French military intelligence officers in Saigon about the vast scale of Chinese aid to the DRV army, estimated by March 1954 at over 300,000 strong, no longer seemed outlandish. The siege was a colonial war on a Second World War scale. Both sides were pushed to breaking point by the battle, a killing field whose intimate horrors were brought home to the French public like no other empire confrontation hitherto." So Dien Bien Phu was something quite unique for a country like France that was used to colonial conquests and used to violence in colonial war being a fairly one-way matter. Not only was the opponent, the DRV, quite capable of fighting, but also fighting on a scale that one would have anticipated with the Second World War, which was, as far as the French were concerned, a First World Affair, wars between the First World Powers. Colonial conflict that France was enveloped in was taking on those sorts of proportions, and the colonised were fighting very, very effectively. This is a huge psychological blow, and one that the DRV, the and General Giap particularly, were well aware of. And it was a lesson that was very instructive. It was a lesson that was not forgotten, and it was a lesson that would be repeated during the American attempts to destroy communist power in Indochina. What was learned by the Vietnamese is that colonial powers can only put up with so much, and colonial powers cannot accept the kinds of losses that colonised peoples can accept in their struggle for freedom from colonisation. In that sense, there's a kind of an asymmetric warfare. By the time the Geneva Conference opened on the 26th of April, the French garrison and the DRV both were beyond exhaustion. French Premier Joseph Laniel begged the British to join Eisenhower in a statement of support for the French position in Indochina. Churchill declined, adding rather unhelpfully that he thought it a great mistake to have left this large and important force in so isolated a position. Churchill's remark was merely a statement of what was by then obvious. On the 7th of May, Dien Bien Phu's battered inmates surrendered, and Laniel's 6 months in office ended 5 weeks after that. And as we shall see when we next look at the Geneva Peace Conference, the end of the French era in Vietnam came with the humiliating defeat at Dien Bien Phu. France could have fought on, yes, but there was no political will to do so. And it's very often that's more decisive in whether or not to withdraw. There was no popular mood for further humiliations at the hands of the Vietnamese, and also there were many French people who had precious little interest in Vietnam or understanding really as to why such a protracted war was being fought there. Okay, so we're going to finish there. Thanks very much for listening. I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast, and if you can support us via Patreon, that would be great. You can find us on Patreon, the Explaining History podcast, and do remember to check out our Facebook group, because everyone's welcome there, and there's always new and interesting and cool content to be posted there, which I normally do. Take good care, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.